Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin is home to the nation's only Master Cheesemakers program that provides innovative cheesemakers with continuing education opportunities? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
This week, it's the season finale of Meat and Three. We're following up our episode about youth with a look at age and how aging affects life on farms and in kitchens.
At the most basic level, we need people to grow food for a growing global population.
The question of planning for retirement or old age as a cook, it's almost one that doesn't exist bizarrely until it's too late.
We also have a story about a food that might be older than you think.
A recent archaeological finding might have CrossFitters everywhere reevaluating their diets.
Plus, a story about one of Atlanta's most historic and risque landmarks.
There are dancers that have been there 20 and 30 years.
Don't miss our season finale of Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's episode is a little different. You're going to hear two different interviews, and I'm not in the studio for either one. I'm in Charleston, South Carolina at the FAB Conference, which is all about women in hospitality. The first interview you're going to hear is with Chef Asha Gomez of the Third Space in Atlanta, who was kind enough to sit down with me in between two of the panels that she was a part of at the conference. You're going to hear us talk about her restaurant, The Third Space, that she runs more like an intimate supper club than a traditional restaurant. And we also talk about her cookbook, My Two Souths, and the similarity between Southern Indian cooking and cooking in the American South. The second interview that you're going to hear is my interview with Chef Katie Button of Heirloom Hospitality Group. She's the chef behind Curate Tapas Bar and Night Bell in Asheville, North Carolina. Chef Katie and I sat in the lobby of the hotel that we were both staying in, and we had a great conversation about how she manages her teams and how she sets the example for everyone who works under her. And I want to send a huge congrats out to her because she was very, very pregnant at the time that we sat down, and she's since had her baby, so congratulations, Chef Katie. I can't wait to meet your new child. And here's the show.
My name is Asha Gomez. I am the chef at the Third Space in Atlanta and the author of the cookbook, My Two Souths.
And Chef Gomez, how would you describe your restaurant to listeners who haven't been before?
I don't even know if I can call the Third Space a restaurant, really. It's a culinary conversation that happens there. So it's not a traditional restaurant that's open 5 days or 6 days or 7 days a week. I created an environment where I could dictate my hours and be able to give a very personal, intimate experience for my guest. And so it seats only 36. I do only one seating. I only have about one dinner that's open to the public every week. You have to pre-reserve the seats, so I always know who's coming to the table. And it's really it's an open kitchen concept, so I get to converse with my guest through the whole experience. The whole time that they're having dinner, I get to actually touch them beyond just the plate.
And why was it important for you to have the Third Space be this culinary conversation instead of a traditional restaurant?
So I'm not a classically trained chef. I'm not a restaurateur. I always say the food world found me. I kind of fell upon the food world, and they embraced me, and I loved the embrace. And I said, I'm going to stay a little longer. But in a traditional restaurant environment, which is how I started my career in this industry with Cardamom Hill, I realized that I was not able to really have a balanced life. I loved being a mom to my little boy, and I was not able to devote the time that I needed to as a parent. And just my life in general was not the travels that I wanted to have. I couldn't do very many things in the environment that the restaurant industry has created for us chefs. And so I felt that I had to create a situation for myself that kept me in the restaurant industry, but something that actually worked for me to be able to have a balanced lifestyle.
And what do you think your guests get out of this conversation, this different sort of restaurant experience?
I never have one guest that walks out of our dinner experiences without hugging me. So to me, that is, they become family in that moment, that they walk in the door and they have that experience with me. I'm not behind a closed door where they can't see me and just the food is coming out. They literally feel like they're in my close personal space, as if they're in my home kitchen. I'm telling them stories as I'm cooking and serving them. So it's a really intimate experience. And, you know, 36 strangers walk in and 36 friends walk out. So it's a really special environment.
And speaking of your travels and you, your cookbook is amazing. Can you talk about, like, the inspiration behind it?
So My Two Souths is really, you know, my personal journey. I come from the Indian South. I grew up in the southern region of India in a state called Kerala. I've called the American South home for over 20 years now, two decades. And I love both these traditions and cuisines tremendously. And over the years of cooking both these cuisines, I started finding all these amazing synergies and even certain cooking styles, the influences that came from external parts of the world, because there's so many port cities here in the South. I come from a port city. You know, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the Chinese, the French, all these influences that got intertwined with the cuisines of both these amazing regions that I called home. And it just seemed like a natural evolution for me that came together on a plate. You know, my mother's fried chicken with a low country waffle and spiced maple syrup just all of a sudden came together with a lot of beauty on a plate. So, and I don't like to call my food fusion food. Somehow that word just doesn't ring to the cuisine that I bring. It doesn't sound right to the cuisine that I bring to the table. I honestly believe that food is an evolution of time and people and cultures and tradition. And for me, it's an evolution of who I am as a person, the countries I've called my home, the people that I have cooked with, the kitchens that I have had the pleasure to be in. All this combined is what, you know, dictates what I put on a plate. It's a sum total of my life experiences. And that's an evolution of who I am as a person. It's not fusion.
It's not fusion, it's your life.
It's my life, yes.
So you talked a little bit about the similarities in terms of, like, geography between where you're from in India and the American South. And you talked about this delicious sounding chicken and waffle dish. Can you talk about another dish where you found those sort of similarities that now, like, define My Two Souths in your book?
Sure. I think the other thing that both my souths have in common is rice. You know, there's production of rice in both these regions, and so I find there's so many amazing rice dishes here in the South, and red beans and rice, and, you know, a great jambalaya. And in the southern region of India where I come from, we have something called biryani. These are all dishes to me that really have tremendous synergy just because of where they're geographic, the places they're geographically based in. And so we grow the same kinds of produce. I think the one ingredient that I was fascinated that we had in common was cane syrup. I grew up with my mom using something called jaggery, which is cane syrup before it's melted. And there was always a block of it in our kitchen. And if my mom wanted to cook something, she would shave it like you would shave Parmesan, melt it down, and it would be used as a sweetener. And John T. once sent me this amazing cane syrup, and immediately it was like, oh my God, that's melted jaggery, you know. So then I delved into the history of cane syrup in the South and realized that, wow, that's another thing I have in common with the South. So yeah, the Indian South and the American South.
I love that. That's amazing. And I love what you said about the evolution of food and of Southern food, because this is the food that you're cooking as part of the American story as well. So where do you see that going? Where do you see the evolution going?
So I think for so long, you know, I always say I stand on the shoulders of countless chefs, immigrant chefs whose stories were never told, and yet their lives and their cuisine have left an indelible imprint on the American South, the Americas in general. I'm fortunate enough that my story is being told through my food. I think a lot of it in the past probably had to do with access. There was a language barrier for immigrant chefs, or they didn't have the access to media like we do today, media that can tell our stories. And also, I think we have become, chefs today are more so storytellers, and so we're able to tell a story through a plate of food, which my fellow Americans are really able to connect with that plate of food, because now, you know, I'm connecting dots that make sense for them. So moving forward, I think the possibilities are limitless, and I think that we will be cooking without borders, really. I take from influences from all over the world and bring it into my kitchen and put it on a plate, and that's really what I see the future of, not just Southern cuisine, but American cuisine and global cuisine in general, is that a lot of us are going to cook without borders.
So speaking of evolutions and where you see things going, I think the third space is really avant-garde in that way, in terms of restaurants that don't have, like you said, borders or walls. Do you see the restaurant industry changing that way too, like evolving to be more like a conversation instead of, you know, faceless food coming out from a kitchen?
I hope that concepts like the third space start developing more, because not only are they conversations that happen around food outside of a traditional restaurant business, they're also financially sustainable models, because you don't have the overheads of a restaurant. And so I think this type of model of creating dining experiences, very, very important moving forward. And I know I'm one of the first that started the trend, but more so I'm seeing, you know, there's Orange Dough Kitchen that just opened in Boston. They had come and seen the third space, and I'd given them a walkthrough, and they built something similar. I'm so excited to go check it out one of these days. But it really is a sustainable business model. And so I think it's important that we create dining experiences outside of the rigor of a traditional restaurant space moving forward.
Yeah, you were talking about how that the impetus for making the third space this way was the life that you wanted to create. Do you think other chefs have that desire as well, and that's why we're seeing that? Do you think the restaurant industry needs to evolve to be more like that?
I definitely think we need to evolve to make this business more financially sustainable for our chefs and the restaurant workers and people that work in this restaurant who love it, in the restaurant business, who love it so tremendously. But I think the evolution of spaces like this is especially important considering what we see happening around us today. The sheer stress and pressure that restaurant life can put on someone in that business is gut-wrenching when you look at whether it is substance abuse of some sort, or just that rough, difficult lifestyle that you have when you're in this business. I think these kind of models allow to ease that up a little bit and allow you to have a much more productive, happy, the key word being happy environment where you don't have to deal with those tremendous stresses that come with being a restaurant owner. And I think that's what the third space is for me. I had, somewhere along the line, I had lost my joy in a traditional restaurant. And I knew at that moment that I couldn't do that anymore. And the third space is an environment that constantly finds me in a happy place. And that is so important for my well-being, but also for my guests to experience that certain something when they're eating my food that I can't quite put into words or describe on a plate of, you know, or even express through a plate of food, but it's that feeling that I have when I'm cooking that transcends and translates to the guest experience.
So what would you tell a line cook or a server or a person who wants to own their own restaurant someday, but maybe where they're working isn't like sustainable. What would you tell them? Where are you since, you know, where you are now?
I think you have to think a little bit out of the box. I also believe that people don't understand how difficult running a restaurant is. And so, you know, you see restaurants popping up all over the place all the time that are not sustainable, that don't make it past a few years. And so you really, and this rock star status and that this the young generation has of what it is to be a chef is a far cry from the reality of what the business is and the hard work that goes into running a restaurant business. So my advice is put in the work, work under someone who will teach you and guide you, stay in a place longer than, you know, for longer stretches of time, learn from the establishments that you're in before you decide that this is what you want to do. Like, you really need to learn the industry before you decide you want to open something. And it may not necessarily be a restaurant. It might be a space like the third space, or you may just end up, you know, writing cookbooks, or, you know, there's so many aspects of, you may end up making jams. I don't know. There are so many things in the food world that can keep you relevant. It doesn't necessarily just have to be inside of a restaurant behind a kitchen door. Mm-hmm. I think you could make yourself successful in the industry outside of a kitchen door as well, as important as being behind the kitchen is. And my gosh, for the amount of amazing restaurants I've eaten in and the chefs that I'm crazy about and love what they bring to the table, it's not necessarily for everyone. I know it wasn't for me.
So know what's for you and what's not?
Yes, absolutely. Haste is waste. Take your time, figure it out, learn the industry before you make choices of, you know, opening up establishments. For longevity, you need to really know the business. You can't become a badass rock star chef overnight. It takes time.
I'm curious. Do you have a favorite recipe from your book?
Cookbook. That's such a tough question. The recipe that has been outside of my favorite recipe, the recipe that people seem to love the most is my fried chicken. And I think there's this huge misconception that fried chicken is kind of American and Southern. And every culture figured out that if you drenched a bird in flour and deep fried it, it was probably going to be good. So I think every culture, no matter where in the world you go, they have a fried bird. And I'm kind of partial toward that recipe too. It's a pretty delicious fried bird.
That's amazing. I was just curious. I love asking cookbook authors that question, and they always say, oh, it's hard.
Yeah, it is, because, you know, every one of those ends up being this thing that you worked on and developed and tested, and or you grew up with, or you tasted somewhere that you loved. So they're all so special.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Chef, for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious, fresh and squeaky cheese curds, or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sartori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
All right, so we are here with Chef Katie Button, and you are a chef that's local to the South.
Yes, I was born in South Carolina, in Conway, South Carolina. I did end up living in New Jersey growing up there, I moved back down to the South to open a couple restaurants in Asheville, North Carolina.
And that was after Paris and being in the North for a little bit. And can you tell listeners?
D.C. and L.A. Yes, a lot of places.
Yeah, can you tell listeners a little bit about your journey?
Sure.
North Carolina?
Yeah, I have a non-traditional journey into the culinary industry. I'm certainly not alone in that, but... I when I was in high school and that typical graduating senior who had no idea what I wanted to do with my life, and somebody gave me some good advice about studying something, getting a degree in something that I would get a job in, and following something I was good at, and I was pretty good at math and science, and I ended up getting accepted into the engineering school at Cornell, and I kind of followed that because it was like, oh, a degree in chemical engineering, you'll definitely get a job, and even though I had no idea what that all meant, and those are all the wrong reasons to study something, and then I started studying and, just kind of, like, trudged my way through it, and got to graduation, and I had no clearer picture about what I wanted to do, and so I decided to get a master's degree because when you don't know what you want to do, you keep studying. So, because pretty soon you'll be so qualified that somebody's going to hire you. And then I continued on and I went to, I actually was smart because I found a master's degree program offered in Paris, which is what brought me to Paris, which you mentioned. So I have a master's degree in...
That's okay.
So I have a master's degree in biomedical engineering from École Centrale in Paris. And the entire time I was there, I cooked a lot. And looking back at my time there is like one of those moments that reminded me that I should kind of pushed me to like switch careers. But it took me a little while longer. I went to Baltimore and D.C. and worked in labs and then was about to start a PhD program before I... actually.
You were going to keep studying.
I was going to keep studying because I still couldn't get a job. Because when you don't have like clear direction, you like interview terribly and I didn't know where I wanted to work or what I wanted to do. And I was just kind of like, okay, I'll just like keep studying. And I had this idea of being a professor. I was like, oh, I can teach people because I actually enjoy teaching and talking to people. But I forgot that, along with that, the majority of what you have to do in order to support your teaching is research, and research happens in a lab, and I wasn't really enjoying that side of it. I was really unhappy is what it comes down to. And looking back over the years of what I've been studying, I was not fulfilled by my work, and I was having to reach out. I cooked a lot because I needed something, that I enjoyed to keep me kind of going. But before my PhD program started, that's when I had this moment of, okay, it's now or never. You either get out or you do this for the rest of your life. And I quit. I'd never quit anything before. I'd kind of been on that kind of treadmill of just keep going. And I dropped out of my program 2 weeks before it was supposed to start. Definitely burned the bridge because that's not really smiled upon. but in your 20s, that's what you do. You sometimes burn bridges and as you figure life out. And then I immediately started looking for a position in a restaurant. I grew up, my mother had a catering business. She ran out of our home and food was just a really big part of my life. And that's kind of how I ended up my first step in the restaurant industry.
Yeah, and now you have two restaurants, the Tapas Bar and Night Bell, which, can you describe the restaurants for listeners?
Yeah, sure. So Curate is a traditional Spanish tapas bar, and we recently added a vermuteria, which is a fun, like, kind of other bar concept focused on vermouth, sherry, and cider, all of which we serve on tap, and there's just a lot of fun things about celebrating. It's all about celebrating Spain in that restaurant. And then our second restaurant, Night Bell, is small plates but focused on regional Western North Carolina, kind of Southern Appalachian-inspired cuisine, using all the wonderful products, both farmed and foraged, to create kind of our version of that food.
And you have a cookbook.
I do. I have a cookbook called Curate, and it is about, it's the Spanish cooking recipes from our restaurant, but I wrote them for the home cook, and that was a really wonderful experience. I really enjoyed testing all my restaurant recipes at home and coming up with interesting techniques to do things that we do in the restaurant, but easier and faster at home.
So how would you describe your approach to hospitality at both of your restaurants?
I would say that my husband runs our front of the house service and beverage. And so he's like a master of service. And he worked, we met working for Jose Andres in Washington, D.C. And then, but he had come from working at El Bulli for 5 years in the front of the house service. And I had the opportunity to work there for two seasons as well. And, you know, he just brings... The two of us are what creates our hospitality in the restaurant. We're very much a team. And he, you know, cares for the guests and trains the servers. And he's just so warm and open. And then I work on the food. And, you know, one thing that's important to us is we want it to be casual. Both our restaurants are casual. Service is casual. But you should feel well taken care of. And the biggest thing that we do is train our staff on tasting, like the food, the beverage, all the different components, because we want them to be able to guide the guests through an experience. I find that, like, when people come in a restaurant and they put themselves in the hands of a talented server, that person will create an experience much better than they could have created by, like, picking off the menu by themselves. Right. Particularly when it comes to small plates, because it's like sharing and they can course things out and make things land at the right time, and it's a lot of fun.
And we're here in Charleston for FAB.
Yes.
And hospitality is such... It's going through changes right now, and I feel like this is such an important time to be at a conference like this and to have, like, leadership like yourself here. Why was it important for you to come to FAB this year?
I was, you know, really excited when I heard about it. And then when Randy Weinstein approached me about coming down and maybe speaking on a couple panels. And then I started seeing, you know, not only the list of panels and what we'd be talking about, which was really, like, diving deep into sections of the industry that are really important, and having those kind of tough conversations that you wouldn't normally have, like a session on social justice or failure, or, you know, just really open conversation. And then I looked at all the people that she had gotten to, like, come down here and be here for this, and it's a bunch of really inspiring women in the industry from across the U.S. At different levels and stages in their careers. And I think that's really exciting. And there's a whole bunch of people that I really look up to here. So it's great to be here and learn something from them and also try to give a little piece of what I'm doing to teach somebody else about maybe something new that they didn't know about.
Yeah. So speaking of your panels, I wanted to talk to you about like your leadership style in the kitchen. How do you approach, do you even think of yourself as like the leader of the kitchen, or do you think about it as more of like a teaching, like what kind of atmosphere do you
I would say that, you know, my role is even changing over the years now that we have two restaurants and a cookbook into leader of the business, you know, which before when we first started, it was definitely leader of the kitchen, you know, and but it's growing a little bit bigger because, you know, we're working on a third restaurant concept and just, you know, to be able to grow and provide opportunities for our staff to grow with us and move up into management positions. We're really excited to offer those opportunities, but it just means that my role is becoming a little bit bigger. And as far as my leadership style, you know, I'm definitely not a yeller or a screamer. You know, I'm very systems oriented. I tell everybody who I hire, and this comes from my engineering background, I think, you know, creating systems. I mean, that's what I was taught in school to do. To create systems for success so that things function properly. And so I tell everybody who is thinking about joining our teams, I'm like, look, we're extremely structured. You know, if you like that sort of environment, you're going to thrive here. Like, if you like knowing where you stand, having rules, having systems, having procedures, you know, of course we accept feedback to improve on all those things from our team. But, you know, we're not a kind of fly by the seat of your pants, like throw a few things together and make a special kind of restaurant. You know, it's really important to me, particularly Curate. We serve a large amount of people, and I want every single one who comes in to have the same experience, you know, and to be able to enjoy the food and taste the Romesco sauce, and it's the same, you know, that afternoon as 2 days later, you know. And but that requires creating systems and procedures of ordering and recipes and, you know, so that everybody in our restaurant can do them, because we have quite a big team of employees. We're about 140 employees now.
Wow.
So I'm a leader of a lot of employees now, which it feels great, you know. And it also puts a lot of pressure to be there, like guiding light and to talk about more than just the day in and day out work routine things.
Yeah, so one, that's a ton of people.
Yeah.
That's a big team to run.
It's a big team.
And as you were talking, I was thinking, wow, that it's crazy that that's so rare in the restaurant industry, because, you know, in theory, consistency is the goal.
Right.
You want everyone to have the same quality of experience.
Right.
But a lot of restaurants do fly by the seat of their pants, for lack of a better term. It's just really fascinating that you run the kitchen with that sort of like structure. Is there like room within the structure for a little bit of play as well?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's always room for people to present ideas for new dishes and things, and then we talk about them. And then when it goes on the menu, we create the same system, right? It's like you present an idea, we like it, or tweak it, but then we're gonna create the same recipe systems, because I can't have a situation in a kitchen where one person knows how to make something, right? Because then that one person has to be there all the time,
right?
Whether it's me or a staff member or a sous chef or my chef de cuisine, and that's just not possible. I mean, we're also looking for a balance of life. You know, I don't expect my managers to work 100 hours a week. You know, I expect them to try to keep their hours down to 50, you know, something that's like, you know,
manageable
work and life, because that's what I want. You know, I have a daughter and another child on the way, and, you know, I just, I can't be in the restaurant all the time either. And I don't, you know, I am okay with that. You know, I want to get home for maybe 5 nights a week and be able to tuck my daughter in bed, fix her dinner, you know, and that's okay because, as I said, my role is changing. It's getting bigger. It's getting broader. It's more about our, you know, making sure that my teams are managing and running the restaurants properly and then working on maybe that next concept to create more opportunities for them.
So that is something that I think is, I hate to call it a trend, but it's something that I think more and more chefs care about is creating that work-life balance where maybe like 15 years ago it was you work as hard as you can in this industry and if you get burnt out, you know, so what? We'll replace you.
Right.
How important is it to you to not run things that way, to be a little more, you know, like the work-life balance of life that you were talking about?
Well, I think that I'm setting the example for all the people who work under me, my chef de cuisines, my sous chefs, you know, so, I mean, and they see me work a lot, you know, I work plenty, you know, and then I travel quite a bit, but, you know, I think the fact that I'm not there every service, you know, lets them understand, look, I don't expect that of you either. Like, I don't expect you to run, to open the restaurant and close the restaurant. And I don't expect you to run lunch and dinner service. You know, it's just, it's too much, you know? So we kind of talk about that. And that's really important because I want people who have longevity with us. And in order to be able to grow, for them to have their own families and do things and work for us for the longer term, this has to be a sustainable lifestyle. And that, I think, is what's changing in the restaurant industry, you know, and I think it's really important, and I'm so glad that it's kind of shifting that direction.
Yeah, you talked about clear paths to management, which I feel like I talk to younger chefs about all the time, because it's so important. Like, if someone doesn't see a path to more than what they're doing now, they're probably not going to stay with you.
Right.
And if we're going to make the restaurant industry more sustainable, then we need to be thinking about, okay, how do we keep people in it?
Exactly. I mean, that's exactly right. It's the line cooks need to see growth. You know, they need to see those opportunities. Because for the ones that this is a good fit for, that cooking, they find that cooking is a good fit for them, then if they see those opportunities, they will stay because they know it's coming up, you know. And that's wonderful. And I'm just really, that's a big part of why we continue to grow and create new concepts and things. And then the other thing that we have to do is continue to expand our benefits, you know, for our employees. That's something that's really important to me and something each year we add or expand on a major benefit. And that's something we haven't stopped doing since we've opened, and it's something we'll continue to do because, again, that's part of that supporting a balanced life.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like your team is like your like family. Like you're thinking about how to take care of them and provide for them in like a way that's really like nurturing.
Yes, and you know, and the only thing that I'll say on that is, with 140 employees, I wish that I knew them all better. You know, and I think that's another goal for myself. And I've been trying to take ideas from other restaurant chefs and restaurant owners this week, these couple of days in Charleston. Is, you know, how do I, as we grow, get to still maintain that kind of personal interaction with those employees so that they see me, know me, feel my presence, even though I'm not there all the time.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. I wish more chefs felt like that. It's actually like pretty rare. So what do you see for the future of your restaurant group?
That's, you know, when I get asked that question, I always tell myself, Katie, you need a good answer for that question. Because, you know, what happens is I kind of go through each year and things change and adjust. I mean, as I said, we're opening this third concept, which is a bagel shop's breakfast and lunch kind of sandwich place, which I'm really excited about. And that comes this fall. And then, you know, we have ideas for other restaurants and things. And so I think we'll keep going in that path and I would really like to write another cookbook, something that's more personal and about me and tells more personal stories and maybe and is focused on how I cook at home, you know, because I think that's a conundrum that everybody faces, whether you're a chef or not, that like the thing of getting home at 6 o'clock and needing to get dinner on the table in 30 minutes is like a real life challenge, you know, for everybody, myself included. And yes, I can throw something together from the pantry if I have to, but I like to have a plan, you know, and it's like, you know, so, so those are, that's kind of our growth, but more than that, I really, my bigger goal is to continue to create a business and company that supports its staff and helps solve, there's still so many problems for the people who work for us and the, you know, I mean, the hourly employees, you know, we already pay a living wage and we offer great benefits like health insurance and paid time off and some things that, that are unusual. But I'd love to offer more than that. I mean, we have a transportation issue. We have a affordable housing issue. We have, you know, a retirement, like a 401k plan or, you know, there's so many things that I would like to grow the business into that is almost more important than the concepts that we open.
And I feel like you were talking about your third concept, and like it feels like you're kind of letting the community kind of dictate what they need.
Yes.
Instead of being like, I want to open this molecular restaurant.
Right.
You know?
Yes. That's exactly it. You know, it was looking at Asheville and being like, what am I missing in my day-to-day life when I'm living there? And what do I think people are really going to enjoy? And people have been really, ever since we announced about the bagel shop, they've been super excited about it. So I'm really excited that they're excited. And we're working on formalizing the concept so we can deliver something really amazing. Because if we do it, we have to do it perfect. So that's the only requirement.
That's amazing. So my last question for you, because you have to run off to a panel this morning, is if you could, you know, talk to a younger line cook who was kind of in your shoes, you know, working in multiple different cities or at El Bulli or wherever, what would you tell them?
I would say, you know, to really, you know, find the people who you are working for, who you trust, who can serve as some sort of mentor for you. Like, I think that that's important, and to not be afraid to keep reaching out to those people. You know, it's like, say you work at a place and you have this chef who you just really connected with and admired and felt like you believed in what they were doing, but then you know that you need to move on and do something else because you're still learning. And I understand that, you know, I don't expect people to stay with me forever either. But when, after you leave, like, you know, my advice would be keep checking in with that person, you know, every few months, because you never know, they're the ones, as long as, who are going to be able to think about maybe other opportunities for you down the road, or you can bounce ideas off of and, you know, trust their advice if you, you know, if you really feel confident in that person. So I think that would be my advice.
Awesome. Well, Chef, thank you so much for talking to me. I will let you go, but it was a pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'm so excited to check out bagels.
Yes.
In North Carolina. Exactly. And yeah.
Great.
Have a great day.
Well, thanks so much. You too.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.